Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast for Wednesday, July 22nd. I am Chris Wagner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News. I am joined, as always, in the studio by Christopher Wynn, deputy editor for FD, the style magazine of the Dallas Morning News. Hello, Chris.
Hello, C. Wagner.
And back off the bench after her sick week, it's the return of the great Lauren Smart, arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer. How are you feeling there, Lauren?
I am so much better. Thank you for asking.
That's good to hear because we don't want to get
sick. We brought Purell.
Yeah. On today's show, we're going to geek out with Dallas Morning News super nerds Britton Peel and Mike Michelle. We're going to chat with Ready Player One author Ernest Ernie Cline about his new book, his life in Texas, and what it feels like to have Steven Spielberg, that guy, anoint you to supreme nerd status. Next, we saw the new movie Pixels starring Adam Sandler last night. We survived.
Barely.
Our brain cells, maybe not. Are the film's retro arcade characters attacking the Earth or our intelligence? You'll find out. Finally, it's joysticks off as we reminisce about the video games of our youth and assess the state of gaming today. And now it says I am supposed to welcome Lauren back.
Hello, thank Lauren. You. I think you already did that.
Right, so what happened?
Well,
what'd you eat?
You don't want to know. Breakdown. You don't want to know. Well, but I was, so since I've seen you last, I was in Syracuse, New York, and I got a puppy.
What?
So two big events. So I think all of that stressed me out and it didn't help.
I've seen the puppy on Instagram. It's very cute.
So you got sick because you got a puppy?
No, I'm just saying it all happened at the same time. No.
Okay.
When life hit it, it's you.
That's a dangerous, it's a toxic puppy.
Don't get puppies.
No, that is the lesson.
I caught a puppy.
If you take away anything today, it's don't get puppies.
No.
Or get puppies.
Do get puppies.
Yes. Chris.
You know, I have a comment for you, Chris Wagner, from my good friend Paige in New York. She's the one that told me she saw Trainwreck and was emotionally devastated.
She was like traumatized by the Amy Schumer comedy.
She was. She said it kind of brought up some family issues and made her want to get a boyfriend.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was telling Chris about it at the office afterward, and he just thought it was funny. And thought her reaction was surprising and perplexing. So I told that to her. And Chris, she says to tell you that you're not a single woman in your 30s in New York.
Damn, because I really kind of thought I was.
You don't know. You don't know how it feels.
I'm still just going to kind of go out on a limb and saying this is more on her than on Trainwreck.
Well, I was going to say, you never know what movies will affect you.
That's right.
You never know. I mean, for all we know, people left Pixels and their lives were changed.
we'll see.
But yeah, no, all respect to your friend in New York. It's all good.
There you go, Paige.
No worries. You guys want to get this thing started? All right, let's do it. Singing in the old bar, swinging with the old stars, living for the fame. Kissing in the blue dark, playing pool and wild darts, video games. Austin writer Ernest Cline first achieved elite nerd status with his screenplay for the 2009 Star Wars fandom film Fanboys. His breakout success came 3 years later with the hit novel Ready Player One, a futuristic thriller full of 80s nostalgia that is set to become a movie directed by Steven Spielberg. On Monday, Cline will be in Richardson to promote his new novel, Armada. When does he sleep? Let's find out. Joining us for this conversation is GuideLive.com entertainment editor and video game critic Britton Peel and Dallas Morning News books editor Mike Michelle, whose nerddom I don't think anybody could ever hope to touch. Guys, joining us. Ernie maybe can. And Ernie, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you guys for having me.
So what is it like to have a movie that's going to be directed by some guy named Steven Spielberg?
Crazy time. I tell people that it's like an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge or Vanilla Sky. I assume I died a couple years ago, and I'm just making all this stuff up in my head. Like, sure, you drive a DeLorean, and Steven Spielberg's going to make your first novel into a movie. You know, he's only ever done that once before, adapted a first novel into a movie, and that was Peter Benchley's Jaws.
So, and that one turned out okay.
I know, and that was way, you know, before he even kind of rose to the heights that he's at now. So I'm incredibly lucky. It's like a dream come true that I don't, you know, believe is actually really happening. It's otherworldly.
Ernie, I want to know, this is the other Chris, I want to know, did Steven call you, or is this just something your agent sent you a text about?
Well, I kind of knew that there was a chance that he was circling it like a few weeks before it was announced. So I had, you know, enough time to, and any potentially good news in Hollywood is potentially disappointing news later. So it was a heady time, and I'm still, you know, adjusting to it. And I was actually in the middle of finishing the final edits on my novel, my second novel, Armada, when this happened. So I tried to shut it all out and focus on work, and otherwise, you know, I would have just gone down this rabbit hole of rewatching E.T. and the Indiana Jones trilogy over and over again. But he's actually been up in Vancouver, I think, finishing up the BFG, Roald Dahl adaptation of The Big Friendly Giant. So I think probably later this summer, after my book tour, I will make a trip out to pilgrimage out to Los Angeles, but not until I'm done with all this work.
Have any of you guys seen that Albert Brooks movie where he gets an appointment with Spielberg and it turns out to be Stan Spielberg?
Right, by Stephen Wright.
Yeah, Stephen Wright, exactly. That's the first thing I thought of.
Ernie, when did you realize or decide that you were going to turn your nerdiness into a career?
Well, you know, I never thought that I would be able to do that. I always was interested in movies and writing screenplays, and just sort of wrote them because I was interested in it, and assumed that you know, my screenplays would remain unproduced, like the vast majority of them. But the first real screenplay that I ever wrote for Fanboys ended up getting made. But that took 10 years, that whole process of Fanboys getting made, and I assumed it would never happen until it finally did, and it was almost like 10 years to the day. But that was, you know, that experience taught me that there was no geeky dream that I could dream that's too big, you know, because I wrote a Star Wars fan film and I was going to try to make it in Austin as like a little indie movie like Slacker or El Mariachi or Clerks. But then the script got such a great reaction that it, you know, it snowballed very slowly and gradually into, you know, being like the first Hollywood movie made about Star Wars fans, and it has Princess Leia and Lando and Darth Maul, and William Shatner is in it. I'm an extra in a scene with William Shatner, so like once that happens, and that happened way back in 2009. So, you know, that experience both gave me the courage to dream big dreams, but also crush my dreams a little bit, because the movie ended up getting kind of heavily compromised and changed from what I originally envisioned over this 10-year process, and it kind of taught me that maybe I didn't want to be a screenwriter after all, if I wanted to have, you know, more control over my characters and my story. And so that was what motivated me to write Ready Player One. And the whole time I was writing that book, I wasn't sure I could even get it published. I wasn't sure you could have Mechagodzilla fight Ultraman and not get sued by everyone. But it turns out that's the magic of fiction. You know, you can still kind of do anything in a novel, whereas in a movie you're far more limited by special effects and what you can make happen in front of the camera. So it wasn't until Ready Player One became this unexpected success and a New York Times bestseller that I started to think that I might actually just get to geek out for a living.
Speaking of geeking out, this is Mike, Ernie. When we talked, when Ready Player One was coming out, one of the things that I loved was the way you reacted to sudden fame and fortune, including some of the things that you bought with when you signed the book deal for Ready Player One. I think everybody knows about the DeLorean, which you let me sit in once. Thank you. I appreciate that.
It's a Back to the Future DeLorean.
You have purchased some. You've done exactly what every nerd dreams of doing with a sudden huge amount of money. What, you tracked down your favorite video game, right? Is that
yeah,
was one of your
you know, well, I my favorite video game, Black Tiger. You know, it's like part of I think watching Silver Spoons when I was a kid. Everybody was always jealous of Ricky Schroeder. He had all those video games lined up in his living room. So, you know, it was like a dream to have your favorite video game set to free play in my office. And since, you know, I bought Black Tiger, which is one of my favorite games, and I just most recently bought Battlezone. Battlezone featured in my second novel, and it plays kind of a central role in the story, something that happened with Battlezone. So yeah, I bought both of those. But the DeLorean, you know, that was I'd always wanted one even before I saw Back to the Future. I saw it at a science museum in Columbus, Ohio, here where I'm at right now, called COSI, and they had it in the lobby as the car of the future, and I just fell in love with it. It was, you know, unlike any vehicle I'd ever seen. And then when Back to the Future came out, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, then I really fell in love with the car. But it always seemed like wanting to own Kit from Knight Rider or the A-Team van, like something ridiculous that would never happen. But when I sold both the book and the movie rights to Ready Player One, I realized that I was going to get to go on a book tour and, you know, have an author photo, and I realized I could finally buy a DeLorean. And then I could, since it's an 80s time machine, which is kind of what my novel is, it would be perfect for my author photo, and then I could take it on my book tour around the country, and it would be a business expense. So,
by the way, Ernie, I don't know if you know, do you know there's a gold-plated DeLorean?
I do. There are two that were made for an American Express promotion back in the day, and there's I haven't seen them in person yet, but neither of them have a flux capacitor, and my DeLorean is tricked out not just like the Doc Brown's time machine, but like the protagonist in Ready Player One, I mash in three other 80s super vehicles, the Ghostbusters Ectomobile, so it's got ghostbusting logos and on the doors, and particle throwers mounted on the back, wired into the Mr. Fusion, and I also have like a kit scanner from Knight Rider on the front. And an oscillation overthruster from Buck Rubanza. Well, I take it to the next level, guys.
I was researching just a little bit of homework today. You actually, is that the vehicle you drove to the site where they were excavating all the E.T. cartridges?
Atari game.
And I actually said you actually drove 88 miles on the way there. 88 miles an hour on the way there. That's a trick.
I always keep it pegged at 88 miles an hour just because I've been trying to get an 88 mile per hour speeding ticket the whole time. But cops will pull me over, but they won't give me a ticket. They're like, oh, I can't give you a ticket. This car is too cool. You
know? Dude, this car.
I see the flashing lights and I'm like, oh, somebody wants a photo. And that's always what it is. They're never going to give me a ticket.
If only you could have gone back in time to make sure E.T. was a good game instead of horrible.
I know.
God, that was a bad game.
No, Ernie, Britton and I apparently are going to disagree on this. Did you think it was that terrible a game?
I do not. You know, I'm actually in the documentary they made about the E.T. Atari dig. There's a called Atari Game Over, which is directed by Zach Penn, who's working on the Ready Player One screenplay right now. So he and I became friends during the making of this documentary, which is on Netflix. I kind of am one of the sole defenders of the E.T. game. I grew up, you know, that was one of the a handful, like a dozen Atari games that I had, and I played the hell out of it, and I thought it was a fun game, and it was also the first game ever to have an official Easter egg. The creator, Howard Scott Warshaw, actually hid Indiana Jones, which is one from, he made the Temple of Doom, or he made the Raiders of the Lost Ark game for Atari, and he hid Indiana Jones inside E.T., and he also hid Yar from Yar's Revenge, which is his other game. And I remember
discovering... I was just about to mention Yar's Revenge.
I loved Yar's Revenge.
I love those games, too, so when I discovered these characters from these other two video games hidden in this, it was like one of the first Easter eggs that I ever discovered, so that ended up helping to inspire Ready Player One. So,
by the way,
I have fond
Lauren...
memories of E.T. And there are so many. If you owned an Atari back in the day, there were so many games that were so much worse than E.T.
Yes, I agree.
There are still bad games today.
Yeah, exactly.
I do a lot of freelance game reviews, and games still suck sometimes. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah,
I so feel like I'm bringing a nerd knife to the nerd gunfight right now.
Totally.
That's all right.
I have no weapons right now.
So you have a life, is that what you're saying?
We lost Lauren for a second when you said Easter egg. She kind of made this look like, wait, what?
Yeah, I looked at Chris and I was like, what? Wait. Yeah.
People listening to this should go to Ernie's website, and Ernie, you can give the address, but it is the best use of Atari cartridges ever in the history of the internet, I believe.
Thank you. Yeah, cool. It's just my name, ErnestKlein.com or ErnieKlein.com. I registered both because I'm that big of a nerd.
Ernie, if you could pretend for a moment that we don't know anything about your books, can you give sort of the elevator pitch version for Ready Player One, and then the new one, Armada?
Sure. I think what it is pasted on the paperback cover of Ready Player One is Willy Wonka meets the Matrix, as everybody loves that synopsis. But it's basically, the original idea was, what if Willy Wonka had been a video game designer instead of a candy maker, and he held his golden ticket contest inside his greatest video game creation? That's the basic idea. It's like an eccentric video game designer, billionaire, who's created this virtual world about 30 years from now. He holds a contest to find a worthy successor, and leaves behind all these riddles and puzzles and clues that have to be solved to win control of this virtual world and a vast fortune. And all the riddles and puzzles and clues have to do with things from his childhood and his life that he loves, like old Atari games and Pac-Man and Duran Duran lyrics and Schoolhouse Rock songs and things like that. So I've heard other people describe it as like the Da Vinci Code for nerds. But yeah, that was the basic idea behind it, and that was just a way for me to make the story interesting to me while I was writing it, and have it be fun. I never imagined. I thought I was just writing about my childhood, and I didn't realize I was writing about everybody's childhood, because by the 80s, everybody had the same songs on their radio and the same movies in their movie theater and the same shows on their television. So even in Finland and Norway and Italy, countries that I've gone to tour, they tell me that by the 80s they were watching Knight Rider and listening to 99 Luftballons too. So.
And that stuff really persists, because I'm going to date myself a little bit. I was born in 88, so I was just barely there for the 80s. Child. But when reading Ready Player One, like when you're talking about a real life joust battle, like that resonates so much with me. Like that stuff is still, it was a big part of my childhood, even though I wasn't, technically growing up in that era.
Yeah, it was, and even kids now, like the book is, Ready Player One has been selected at like 20 different colleges and high schools as like a common read, and they assign it as homework. And I initially thought it was just because teachers my age wanted to force the 80s on their students. but kids now, because of it deals with kind of having a virtual online identity and having versus your real world identity, and having a, to deal with social media while you're growing up, are all issues that kids now deal with. And the 80s stuff, there's no such thing as an obscure reference anymore, because they're usually reading the book on an iPad, and they can just, if there's an Oingo Boingo video reference, then they can just pull that up and be watching it
for
in like 30 seconds. So it's a multimedia primer on the 80s for them.
And what can you tell us about Armada?
Armada is kind of like my tribute to Star Wars and Ender's Game and The Last Starfighter and The Bishop of Battle, like, and Tron, kind of games, movies that I grew up with, where kind of that fantasy that I had ever since I first played Space Invaders. I played Space Invaders for the first time, I think, right after I saw Star Wars for the second time in 1978. And back before the VCR, when you had to wait for the movie to come back around to your theater, and I immediately remembered, like, the first time I played a video game, I was imagining that I was Luke Skywalker, on his Death Star trench run. I later found out in my research for Armada that Space Invaders was directly inspired by Star Wars, along with Asteroids and Defender and all the early space games. And so I'd always kind of grown up building a starship cockpit out of couch pillows in front of my television, and playing Star Raiders or Star Master or Starship or any game with Star in the title in front of my TV, and like imagining that I was really piloting a spaceship. So that had always been one of my fantasies. And then in around 1981 or 82, I remember reading this article about Battlezone in a video game magazine. This is why I recently bought Battlezone. And Battlezone was this realistic tank 3D battle game, and it was so realistic that the U.S. Army saw its potential as a training simulator, and they bought the game from Atari, and they paid the original programmer, Ed Rotberg, to reprogram it into a tank simulator called Bradley Trainer to train soldiers to operate the Bradley fighting vehicle, which had just been rolled out. And so they only made a prototype of the game, but just hearing that the Army, almost immediately, as soon as video games existed, the military saw their potential as a training tool. And that, as a 12-year-old kid who spent all his time playing video games, that just set my imagination on fire. And then a few years later, when I saw The Last Starfighter and read Ender's Game, which both kind of played different played off that fantasy in other ways, then it's been a lifelong fantasy of mine. But I didn't want to just rehash those stories with Armada. And the two kind of innovations that happened that gave me the idea behind Armada are quantum data teleportation, which is kind of using Einstein's spooky action at a distance to transmit data with no time lag. Like if we had the probe to Pluto, we were connected to it using this technology, we wouldn't have to wait like an hour for radio signals to get there and back. You could just control it immediately with no time lag. And the other thing is marrying that idea with the idea of the rise of drones in our military. My brother is a major in the Marine Corps and an explosive ordnance disposal technician, and they use drones to disarm bombs from a distance, from a safe distance, kind of telepresence robots. And as you guys probably know, our Air Force and is moving into almost using drones exclusively. I saw they're going to make a sequel to Top Gun finally, and Maverick is going to be a drone pilot in it, because that's what's where our Air Force is going. So once I, had that idea, if you could control drones, from any distance, across the other side of the galaxy, then there would be no reason ever for aliens to send, soldiers in ships down to die. And the same way that we don't, you know, we're moving towards not doing that anymore. And once I had that idea, then it kind of made me rethink Star Wars and all of science fiction. Now when I watch Star Wars, I wonder why they're not using drones. I mean, they can make real-time holographic phone calls between planets, but they can't make a remote control X-Wing or TIE fighter. They have to send Porkins down to die senselessly in the Death Star. So that idea of if all the video gamers of Earth could use their Nintendos and PlayStations and Xboxes and phones to control drones to fight off an alien invasion that was also being conducted by aliens using drones, then it would be like a video game war, and the outcome would be decided by the gaming skills of each civilization. And as soon as I had that idea of like the gamers of Earth defending their neighborhoods with their video game consoles, I'd never seen that idea in any science fiction or movies. In Star Wars and Ender's Game and The Last Starfighter, nobody's controlling drones. They're still sending people to die senselessly in battle. So that that idea all kind of poured in to Armada.
Ernie, this is Mike. One of the conceits that I liked in Armada was the idea that all of the things that you mentioned, Star Wars and the video games, all were part of a giant government plot to get the people of Earth ready to defend from the alien invasion. And I was wondering, when did that idea first come to you? Did you ever, you know, that sounds like something that I would have thought of when I was 12 years
well,
old.
You kind of like, well, I think it came from just growing up a child of Star Wars. I was 5 years old when I saw Star Wars, and then the next year I played Space Invaders, and that was right around the time that I got an Atari 2600, you know, which was to me like a combat simulator in my living room. And I wanted to be Luke Skywalker so badly that I dressed up as him, as you know, for 3 Halloweens in a row, I think. So it seemed like nice. Star Wars and everything that followed it, like the reboot of Buck Rogers and Battlestar Galactica, it all was making me want to go in a spaceship and fight aliens better than any propaganda could. And that the video games I was playing were training me to do that very thing. So it was always kind of an idea lurking in the background. And once I started to think about, you know, how an alien invasion would go down if one happened tomorrow, you know, everybody would have, you would have all these expectations based on watching 50 years of alien invasion stories from War of the Worlds, Independence Day, V. You know, I hate it when I see a zombie apocalypse movie and nobody in it has ever seen a zombie apocalypse movie. They have to figure out what's going on all over again. So I kind of wanted to tell an alien invasion story where all the characters were in it were aware of all the, you know, alien invasion stories and the tropes of those stories, and that those would somehow inform the story. But I don't know, there might actually be something to that, man. I think because if there was an alien invasion tomorrow, we would everybody would still freak out, but not as much as if the idea had never occurred to them. And the idea has been, you know, kind of that aliens could come and invade. That's been jammed into my brain ever since I was, you know, 5 years old. So that was just a fun way to weave that and all these, you know, kind of video game legends into, make them part of this grand conspiracy.
Ernie Cline's new novel, Armada, is available now from Random House. He'll be at Alamo Drafthouse in Richardson on Monday. That's coming this coming Monday, July 27th at 7 p.m. for a talk and book signing. Bring your own lightsaber. Ernie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me.
Pixels is the new sci-fi action comedy starring Adam Sandler as a former 80s Pac-Man video game champion trying to save the world from marauding arcade game characters come to pixelated life. King of Queens star Kevin James plays the president of the United States, which probably tells you everything you need to know about Pixels. Four of us saw it last night. Britton Peel reviewed it for the Dallas Morning News. That will be in the guide section on Friday. So what did we think of this movie? Britton, why don't you start off, since you're both reviewing, you've written your review of the film, and you are the gamer guy.
I've already spent way too much time thinking about Pixels, but I'll think about it a little bit more.
Okay, that's Britton Peel.
For those that don't know, Pixels is actually kind of based on a short film from 2010. And it was this exact same concept, that aliens come down in the shape of pixel, you know, Space Invaders, Tetris pieces and stuff. And it's just a 2-minute, like, really cool short film. And it worked perfectly in that short space.
I think that Pixels has about 2 minutes of good content.
Yeah, so if you took out the set pieces from Pixels and just made, you know, just had the Centipedes moment, just had the Donkey Kong moment, you could have some okay short films that could serve as sequels to that original short film, and it'd be okay. Stretching it out to a real mess of a comedy was, I think, a big mistake, and it was not an enjoyable.
Don't you think that the biggest problem? Well, there are lots of those. But
where do you begin? Yeah.
Right, but so Patrick Jean was the New York filmmaker who made the short film, and his premise compared with the premise of Pixels, which I guess I'll take on the, like, basically in Pixels the movie, you know, they were gamer kids, they grow up, and then Adam Sandler is a good for nothing nerd, like, fixer upper guy.
Geek squad.
Like we all are.
And he, yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No.
Yeah, totally.
But then, so he gets called on into the Oval Office by the President of the United States because.
Played by Kevin James. Yes.
And they are going to fight these aliens who've invaded Earth because they got a time capsule with the video games, thinking that it was like a threat.
Of course, because, you know, intergalactic aliens are going to be really stupid.
Right. Well, and so, but compared to the original short film, which was just they came out of an old television
right.
set,
yeah.
which I think I kind of prefer.
Yeah, there was something more like Saturday morning cartoon about that original concept that I think would have worked better. You know, there were moments when they tried to have fun. Like they had Q-Bert as a animated psychic for most of this movie.
Which, by the way, I mean, he just emerges seemingly out of nowhere.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody cares that he's a pixelated alien creature.
He's a trophy.
Oh, we'll be friends.
Yeah.
Well,
but
yeah.
That felt like their attempt to, like, hey, let's have, you know, have kid-like fun with this movie.
It's and pretty cute.
He, for most of it, he's pretty cute.
Yeah. Well, until the last moment. They totally jumped the shark with the last moment of the movie, which... I don't know. Spoiler alert. They turn him into this, like, sexy, made-up female character.
Yeah, a woman who has zero lines in the entire
Q-Bert
film.
Hot
yeah.
No.
Well,
I never realized Q-Bert.
Q-Bert was always hot, Chris.
And I'm sorry, as the woman in the room, they turn the one hot female into a literal trophy. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. Nothing metaphorical about it.
No.
She is a trophy.
It was what it was. Yeah.
And I mentioned in the review that, like, look, I'm a huge video game fan, and I will be the first to admit, we have not had the greatest track record with representing women in video games. But we don't have to let that carry over to our movies based on video games either. Let's do a little bit better.
Well, and just to harp on this for one more moment, the main woman, Michelle Moynihan.
Mm-hmm.
Who
was supposed to be played by Jennifer Aniston, by the way.
Oh, really? Yeah. She was smart to get out.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah.
So Adam Sandler makes a move on her in the closet after she's had a messy divorce and she's crying. Like, and he tries to kiss her. I was just like, can we not treat women a little bit better?
Well, she tells him to buzz off.
Yeah.
I didn't think that was quite
as bad.
But then
she ends up with him.
Yeah. So then later on in the movie, she agrees to go out with him to this big ball that's being thrown in his honor.
Because that was believable.
Adam Sandler's idea of, like, good pickup line, get this conversation going is, hey, tell me about the woman that your husband left you for.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing?
See, I'm going to take a slightly different tact here and say I've seen much worse Adam Sandler movies than Pixels. So I came into this saying this is going to be an Adam Sandler movie. It was produced by his company. I don't think it's a good movie, but I think it's better than his Mr. Deeds remake. I think it's
which is saying nothing.
I think it's better than that Nicky Devil movie. I'm not saying it's great, but I'm saying
Adam Sandler's shtick is just wearing thin. He looks tired. It's like we're tired of this character of that movie.
You know what? You know who says that's not true? The box office.
I know. I need to say that.
And I actually think he's less Adam Sandler-y in this movie than I've ever seen him. He's the worst part of a film he's in.
Yeah, he was not my least favorite part of this movie.
I found him somewhat appealing. This movie.
Yeah,
in kind of a down-to-earth schlub kind of way.
He was the most likable of not very likable characters.
I don't know. Mike is shaking his head.
Oh, I have nothing to contribute to this except to say that Adam Sandler peaked with the Hanukkah song.
Oh, yeah, he peaked up.
Where he points out that Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock are Jewish.
Don't forget, he was very funny on Saturday Night Live,
yeah.
I think he was one of the bright spots of those years as a cast member. I hate most of his movies, but I still cling to, you know, the,
well, I wish you would have brought some of that to
Cajun Man and the Hanukkah song and all that stuff.
The bright spot for me was Josh Gad, and I loved his sort of karaoke version of Everybody Wants to Rule the World. I kind of wanted to hear more of that song. Butt slapping the Marines around. Yeah. I thought he was actually funny. I thought he brought some energy to it, and I thought he was a good character.
He's always good.
Yeah. I think he's great in what he does. I didn't appreciate the character all that much, just because, right. I mean, that to some extent, this is a movie about people like me, like people who grew up playing games and have had that dream of maybe one day I'll be good enough at this stuff that I can make a living out of it or whatever. And as much as they were making these characters the heroes, they still had to really, really lean into, hey, Josh Gad's character can't talk to women, and like, you know, all this.
Yeah, what a stereotype.
Yeah, he's like
lives
one of
the
most,
basement with his grandma.
Yeah, one of the most socially awkward people ever. Yeah, so but
stereotypes
but
aside,
he
entertained me, which I desperately needed in the course of this film.
And he can deliver a joke better than the rest of them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this popular fantasy, because it ties right into Ernie Cline's work as well. This idea that all these hours that you've spent playing video games could actually be preparing you for saving the world, or, you know, gaining great riches. It's sort of like this ultimate nerd fantasy that clearly has some kind of foothold in pop culture right now.
Well, and Ernie Cline is an example of it working in a way.
Right, how it could be done well.
How he could actually use it as something to spend his life doing.
And yeah, Pixels flirted with that a little bit. Like, I think I brought up the Centipede scene earlier, but when there's a scene fairly early in the movie where the game that the aliens are playing is Centipede, and tired of watching the Marines try and fail to play Centipede, Adam Sandler grabs a gun and does it himself. And there was a moment there where I was like, yeah, this,
it's like,
he knows what he's doing.
Play.
Like, this is awesome. And it's...
That was a pretty good scene, actually.
Yeah, it is definitely something. There's something to that idea.
It's basically a real-life Centipede game in the middle of Hyde Park. Yeah. In London.
Like a hologram. I want to play that game. I also like that Pac-Man, the Pac-Man scene where Pac-Man is kind of chomping through the city, and they had that moment of equipping Mini Coopers as the ghost.
Yeah, but they had to be the ghosts.
Yeah, which made no sense.
I thought it was kind of fun. And
I thought it was an interesting reversal.
I thought it was a fun
actually.
Twist to it. And I liked that the license plates had the ghost names, which I had forgotten until that moment last night.
Inky, Blinky, Pinky, and Clyde.
And why Clyde,
why
by the
Clyde?
Way? Poor Clyde.
Hey, I have a question that I should know
why
the
ghosts
answer to.
In a maze? That's
was that actually the creator?
You're taking
creator
it too far, Mike Michelle.
Was that
too much thought.
Was that actually the creator of Pac-Man?
That is the creator's name, but that was not the actual
guy. That was not it. Okay.
I wondered about that, too.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Toro Awatani. I can't
remember. Awatani.
Yeah, thank you.
So if it sounds like Britain is taking this a little personally as a gamer, some people are taking it far more personally. And I want to talk a little bit about Bob Chipman, who
Movie
is
Bob.
At Movie Bob, just went off on an epic Twitter rant about Pixels the other night. I'm just going to read some of the highlights. One of them touches on our own Ernie Cline, Mixed Media's own Ernie Cline. Everyone apologized to Ernie Cline Everybody apologized to Ernie Cline for the Armada is everything wrong with gamer culture takedown. Should save that bullet for Pixels. There's a female character in Pixels who is literally a trophy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the purpose of her character. I think my favorite one is, I want to feed this movie through a malfunctioning industrial shredder cock first. This guy really does not like
this
Pixels.
This time it's personal.
I'm just going to go out on a limb again and say he didn't like the movie.
It was just bad. It was crass. It felt like a marketing machine. I actually preferred the movie this could have been in the opening setup, where you had young Adam Sandler and kind of his geeky friends, and they're playing arcade games, and he kind of goes up against this, you know, evil narcissist, the mulleted Eddie the Fire Blaster, and they're competing at the Donkey Kong World Champion.
It's Peter Dinklage.
Hit, and with the worst accent I've ever
What
heard.
Was that accent?
I don't know.
It was like a British black hip hop.
Yeah, it felt a little racist to me, actually. I don't know. I was
kind of odd.
It was terrible.
But I think that story to me would have been more interesting. You had Chris Columbus, the director who did Home Alone and two Harry Potter films, and who wrote Goonies, which I loved, and Gremlins. Imagine if he had been writing this and put something together. It could have been actually a really interesting.
He did make the two worst Harry Potter movies, though.
Well, but still.
I think it's a good excuse to just remind everyone to go watch King of Kong.
See, dude, you're stealing my tout.
But that's right. Okay. Way to go, Britain.
I can't, like I said, I'm bringing a knife to the nerd gunfight.
So I have a question as probably the least nerdy person in the room.
Well, I just see. Because I've never played. Lauren's like, smart. Not a nerd.
Burn.
She's awesome.
That's not what I'm saying. I just, for me, the like nostalgia, the seeing the characters show up, and then there would be like there at one point there was the dog from
Duck Hunt.
Was that something that, I mean, was that exciting for you each time you saw it?
Did that
without,
turn you on?
Without those moments, Pixels would have been nothing.
Okay.
Wow.
So yeah, there is something to that where it was like, oh yeah, Duck Hunt dog. I know that dude.
Yeah.
And, hey, it's Paperboy. Paperboy's
in it. Well, yeah. Maybe I need to go see
Was
it,
Dig Dug in it?
The monsters from Dig Dug were, I don't know if
okay.
The
I kept looking
the
for
protagonist,
Dig
the well known named protagonist of Dig Dug, I don't know, made an appearance.
It's Bob Dig Dug.
And while you're talking cameos, don't forget Serena Williams, Martha Stewart.
Yeah,
very,
what?
Very briefly.
That was creepy.
Known
and
video
gross.
Game personalities, Martha Stewart.
Yeah. What was interesting was the technology where the aliens used like vintage footage of Madonna from the 80s or Daryl Hall and John Oates to transfer messages to the
that
humans.
That was the best part of the movie.
It was kind of awesome. How did they do that?
The strange. Well, but then what were the aliens actually trying to accomplish, and does it matter?
Nobody knows.
I didn't care. I was entertained for 30 seconds, so I just overlooked it.
Even Q-Bert, who was one of the aliens, isn't quite sure what his people want.
I don't know. Madonna looks really pissed off. You guys should do something.
Yeah.
See, I went in expecting just abominable, and instead I just got merely terrible. So I didn't feel all that bad.
I'm going to go with abominable for you.
Okay.
I'll actually go with, just terrible, not abominable.
It was just too, if they could have compressed some of the good stuff into about 30 minutes, I wouldn't have hated it.
Sure.
Pixels debuts in theaters Friday. Go see it if you want to. We'll be right back. You're listening to Super Sounds of the 80s. That's little Buckner and Garcia to get your day started. Pac-Man fever. From Pong to World of Warcraft and beyond, video games have come a long way. We thought it would be fun to just take a moment and talk about our own video game lives, past and present. You know, I think for almost everybody, certainly people of, you know, Michelle's age and my age, you'll always remember when you got your first Atari 2600. It just seemed like this oracle had arrived under your Christmas tree, and combat seemed like the next, just so next level. Ooh, these tanks, they're shooting at each other and making weird noises. So I was definitely sucked in that initial generation. And my sister used to just kick my ass at everything, in video games, I mean.
Right, yeah.
And which is probably why I stopped playing them at some point. She was like, she's like the Sandler kid in Pixel. She knew all the patterns. Mm-hmm. She used to just, you know, play for hours on a quarter, and everybody would mean mug her at the arcade.
Well, I was like the last person I knew to get an Atari 2600.
Oh.
It was at Christmas. I had 5 gifts under the tree. I opened them one at a time, and each one was a book. And my parents tell me that I was trying so hard to be like, oh, this is great. Thanks. Oh, wow. Oh, it's another book. Everybody else got great gifts. I got books.
No socks or anything?
No, just 5 books in a row. And then finally at the end, my dad was like, oh, wait, I forgot something.
Oh.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I forgot something.
He disappears into the bedroom, comes back out with the Atari 2600. I ripped off the paper and I burst into tears. And I just started crying. And I'm tearing up now in the studio.
That's beautiful. Aww.
And I think I had like Asteroids was the game they bought to go with it.
But. See, some of us had to work for our first Atari.
Did you really?
Got my first job in journalism, delivering the
to pay for your Atari.
Delivering
your Atari
the Slidell habit? Daily Times to buy. It was actually I had the Sears Telegames version, $179.99, in the Sears catalog.
Oh my gosh!
I worked for took 3 months of pay. And It was beautiful, man. I'm weeping just thinking about it now.
And I definitely remember the arcade heyday. I remember we had the Silver Ball right off of Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley.
Nice.
And we had Town and Country.
The we
weird
Spaceport.
Name for an arcade.
Yeah.
Spaceport's a good one.
There was
a
I think
name.
That was actually a chain. This was at the mall near my town. It actually looked like a spaceport, looked like one of the rooms off the Death Star.
Even just hearing that song, it brought back the memories of being in that arcade. And I laugh about it now because now I'm such a germaphobe. I won't touch a door handle or whatever. But then I would spend hours just my hands all over the plastic buttons and playing those games and chugging Cokes, which I also wouldn't.
And you don't know where those other hands had been.
I mean, seriously. I mean, think about it.
A bunch of 12-year-old boys.
You don't know where those Cokes had been either.
Right. Yeah, well, that's true, too. But, oh, it was such an experience. And I wonder, Lauren and Britton, was that – what was this like for you guys coming on a little bit – later?
I mean, sadly, arcades were already kind of dying when I was young.
Yeah,
well, no, but it really sucks. Like, the arcade was the little section on in the corner of the movie theater that, you know, there would be some coin-op machines.
Where the dirty
there.
Man would go stand by the arcade. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, kid, are you playing Centipede?
Yeah.
There is a cool place, though,
this took a dark turn.
There is a cool place that's still around called Nickelrama. I think it's in Garland.
Yeah.
I had a lot of birthday parties there, and their whole thing was like, hey, we've got all these arcade machines and you just pay to get in, and then everything that would be a quarter is a nickel.
Nice.
So I spent a lot of time still playing a lot of older games and kind of newer games back when it was basically just Midway making stuff, the newer Mortal Kombat's and Gauntlets and stuff. But I definitely had a love for that culture, and even as a kid, kind of always wished, like, man, I wish these were still a bigger thing. They just weren't.
L smart.
Well, I wasn't allowed to have a video game, like any kind of play.
Of course not.
Did they let you watch the television?
Lauren, are you still reading Shakespeare?
Yeah, right. But I did. I played computer games. I don't know if that counts. But
like what?
Well, I got really obsessed. Well, my mother took it away from me eventually.
Oh, here it comes.
I got
the
really obsessed
out.
With Age of Empires for a while.
Oh,
that was made here in Dallas. Yeah, in the area.
Yeah, so I was really, really good at it. I had my tribe of workers and a really awesome village, and I played that in SimCity and all the Sim roller coaster theme parks and stuff like that. But I didn't ever play video games. My aunt actually had a old school Nintendo, like the original. She collected antiques, and so
old
I would play.
School.
I feel
antiques.
So old.
I still think of Nintendo as the new one. It's I was telling my I have a 10-year-old son who has the Xbox and the Wii, and I say, you know, I really can't handle a controller more complicated than just the joystick with the one button. It's everything, and it's gotten a lot more complicated than that now. I can't even, you know, I'm amazed, you know, at I see the Xbox games that my kid plays, and, you know, he'll be as obsessive as my friends and I were about them, but he'll play like this Lego Marvel game. I'll walk by, he'll play it every day for a month, and every day the screen is something completely different. It's a completely different type of game for him, and I say, what happened to the old game? Well, this is just a new level, Dad. They keep this.
Hello.
So they're so intricate and different. It was a simpler age when I was coming up, but I think we were that was the first era where the technology was really where people could really bond with the technology like that. I mean, we were
definitely
like
the area where
guinea pigs
era where everybody started staying indoors all day to play.
Yeah.
Because outside was scary.
You know, well, you were glued to it.
There were strangers out there.
Yeah, I mean, the games are addictive. I remember a while back my partner was playing Diablo. Do you remember like Diablo or maybe it was World of Warcraft? And we had a big snowstorm. And I was like, hey, let's go out and see it. And it was like, no, he wouldn't go because he was playing this game.
There's snow in Azeroth.
Yeah.
That's
true.
Special about that.
Yeah, that's the real snow.
So, Britton, you're the only one in this room who is still qualifies as a gamer and who keeps up with the industry.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you get into it, and what is the state of union right now?
I mean, when I was young, my dad had an NES,
what is that?
The Nintendo Entertainment System. That is the when people think that old Nintendo, that is that. And then my uncle had an Atari, so I kind of grew up with those, and then the Sega Genesis was the first system I actually owned outright myself.
Did you ever have a ColecoVision? Do you remember that?
I didn't. In fact, right now I have a bunch of, I have a stack of ColecoVision games and television games.
Those were
But I don't have either of the systems.
Pretty good for the time.
That's what I graduated up to after Atari.
I love. Yeah. I had a friend with Coleco. I've never gone back and been able to find it. It was one of the first talking games that I remember. It must have been called B-17 Bomber, because all I can really remember about it is that when you played it, when you turned it on, it would go, E-17 Bomber. And I get a warm, fuzzy feeling just thinking about that. So can I come over and play later?
That's going to be my new ringtone, is Mike Mershell's.
E-17 Bomber. Which is not as, you know, some of this stuff plays, you know, it gets hardwired in, it gets looped in. I've got a whole, you know, sometimes when I'm driving down the freeway, I will, you know, and somebody cuts me off, I'll find, hear a voice in my head, you know, saying something like, "Run, coward." And that's the voice of anybody. That's Sinistar. Yeah, thank you.
Beware.
Yeah. You know, it's, I think some of that might have done some permanent damage to me, but
You say damage. I say it's made things a lot more magical.
So what is happening in gaming today, Britton? I mean, what are the trends? What are the cool kids doing?
It's really interesting being where I am in life and being where the video game industry is, because it is a lot like the beginning of the movie industry. You know, if you look back at stuff like Pong, that is kind of our train pulling into a station. This is, you know, super simple. Nowadays, we have so much more that is narrative-driven. That's so much more about stuff that actually has messages. Mm-hmm. It's not about... It always makes me upset when, you know, there's a video game controversy in the mainstream media, and, you know, they're all about, like, yeah, players get high scores for killing people. Like, high scores, like, kind of don't exist anymore for a lot of games. Now, you know, right. If you want to play a game about gender dysphoria, there's a game for you. Wow. If you want to play games about depression and stuff, like, there's all these kinds of... Yeah, and a lot of it is that in the past decade especially, there's been a huge explosion of independent games. So in the indie space, there are so many people, you know, that are just one person or a few people just getting together saying, you know, hey, we have this experience we want to tell and we want to do it in an interactive way. And there's some just extremely cool stuff coming out of there that, you know, if you look back to Gauntlet and Joust, like, you maybe wouldn't have thought this is what we were going to get to eventually. But it's some fascinating stuff, and I think we haven't yet reached the peak. We don't have our Citizen Kane of games, is something that a lot of game journalists say, is that we're still looking for that game that's going to kind of change everything. But I think we're getting a lot closer.
I just imagine this video game of Charles Foster Kane walking around his mansion. Rosebud. We talked a little bit about the sexism that we all saw.
Like Grand Theft Auto.
In Pixels. Yeah. This has become a real big story in the game world now, with Gamergate especially. What are your thoughts, Britton?
Well, they don't like me very much because I was on a mailing list. And I'm colluding with people. It's so dumb. But to some extent, I get where some people in that camp are coming from, because they're enjoying something and they, you know, no one likes to be told, hey, this thing you're liking is bad for you, or this, you know, you could be a better person. That's never a good feeling. But you need to learn, you know, to accept that criticism and grow from it. Otherwise, you're not going to get very far in life. It is a big issue, but I think it's one that, as a whole, the game industry is doing a pretty good job of moving beyond. We have a lot of work to do, beyond a shadow of a doubt, but you're seeing more women in video game journalism. You're seeing more women designers. You're seeing more... I think at this year's E3, there were more women on stage presenting than there had been in previous years. So it is getting better very slowly, but I'm encouraged by some of the things I see.
Well, it seems to me, too, like growing up, it was something... Dudes played video games. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're kind of removing the gender binary things all through our lives. And I think this is in one place, and maybe in which it's changing, too. girls are going to grow up and they're going to be, it's going to be acceptable that a girl's sitting around playing video games with her brothers. And
yeah, and there are a lot of people that will say, like, you know, we love girls that play games, but the caveat they have is that they love when girls will play games like a guy does. Like, they expect, you know, they want the girl to come sit, chug beer with them and play Halo. Whereas there's some girls that are more interested in playing a game like Gone Home, which is a 2-hour narrative experience where you do a lot of walking. It's a game all about you're going to your parents' house and you're basically rifling through their
That's
things.
A video game?
Oh yeah. See, and a lot, it's come under there's a lot of criticism because some people say it's just a walking simulator. There's no, you know, there's no game to it. Whereas I compare it kind of to a short story because you're dropped in front of this house and you go in and the experience of the game is you looking through the house, looking at journal entries, looking at what videotapes are by the TV and stuff, and piecing together the story of what's been going on with your family while you've been away at college. And it's fascinating.
Wow. That sounds depressing.
I know.
It's a really
I don't need a video game for that.
Is that the depression game that you
referred
to earlier?
I think I've done that before.
My family is why I like to kill the aliens.
I actually think most people in this room would actually like Gone Home.
It actually sounds really fascinating.
Yeah.
I think that's a challenge. I think we have a mixed media challenge.
So it's an interesting thing because we're getting to that point where games don't have to be fun. You know, if you think of movies, you know, Schindler's List isn't a fun movie. You don't go home and say, I'm going to relax after a hard day of work and watch this movie about, you know, bad things. And games are getting to that point too where you don't sit down and say, like, I'm going to enjoy this experience. You sit down and say, I want to experience this narrative that someone has laid out for me that, you know, maybe I won't feel very good about myself or about the world after it, but I might be better for it.
Yeah, so you think that I was going to ask if you think that there is actually room for growth, like human growth potential
in
video games.
Yeah, for sure. And we're still, you know, at the tip of the iceberg on that stuff, but I think it's definitely there.
Mike Michelle, you were saying you were going to drop some critical theory on us, some hardcore thought on video games.
Well, and this is more in the context of talking about Ernie Klein and the hole in the you know, it obviously sounds like this Pixels movie, as bad as it was, is capitalizing on this wave of nostalgia about them. And it's the second one. What was that other one that came out about a year ago? It was actually a good movie based in a video game land.
Wreck-It Ralph?
Oh, Wreck-It
yes,
Ralph.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, Wreck-It Ralph, thank you. A couple years ago.
Which I have not seen yet.
That's a very good. It's all based on this idea of video game nostalgia. So I've had this theory. I predicted this. There are witnesses. Back there, for people my age, I've always had this theory that video games would be the nostalgia for our generation, you know, people born who grew up in the 70s and 80s. It would be what oldies were to the baby boomers, in the sense that people forget there was a time when it was actually hard to hear music from the 50s and 60s on the radio. And, you know, now it's all that you hear. But there was like this thing that connected people to their youth, and then it went away for maybe a decade, and then it came back, and everybody said, oh, it reminds me of all these happy times. Video games are like that for our generation. There was an era where you could not play an Atari game, you could not play a console game for about a decade. You could, if you're like me, you found little repositories online and spent way too much time, you know, with these, you know, emulators, and so you could, you know, keep your skills up, I guess. But it was very difficult to see them. And then all of a sudden, everyone said, you know, I remember playing Pac-Man. I remember gathering around with my friends playing Defender, and we would watch John wail on those aliens, and we'd have our quarters lined up, you know, so we could be next in line. And it's a specific kind of nostalgia that connects you. And I think we're at the crest of that wave right now. I think, you know, right now we're still, you know, it's Atari and Pac-Man, and it sounds like this game is all 80s characters. You know, I'm guessing that you were a couple of years away from people having, Xbox and Wii nostalgia.
Yeah, and that's kind of a weird thing that, like, I definitely grew up with, like, the Nintendo 64 and that kind of stuff, but it's still weird to see people with nostalgia for that era of stuff.
90s nostalgia is a thing now.
Yeah, and
Friends nostalgia, Seinfeld nostalgia.
But even what you were saying, Michael, about, you know, that specific era, it's that is part of game development right now too. There's a lot of people actually making new games, and it's mostly indie studios, but they're making new games in the style of the old Nintendo or old Atari stuff. One great example is a game called Shovel Knight that I don't think they quite met their goal, but their goal was kind of to make a game that would have run on the original Nintendo hardware. I think they surpassed that a little bit, but it still has that look and feel of something from the late 80s, early 90s. And it's some really cool stuff that's happening as a result of that nostalgia.
Do you guys want to stick around for Touts, Britain?
I guess so.
Mike. Yeah, why not? you don't have to.
We don't want to put you out, man.
Twitchy, twist your arm. come back in a moment, and we'll tout stuff. So we are moving on to our touts. This is the portion of our show where each of us recommends one thing we are reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, or just plain obsessed with. You can tell I really like saying that part of the script. Britton Peel, what would you like to tout today?
Hey, remember that scene in Pixels where Peter Dinklage's character somehow entered a cheat in real life and somehow cheated in a real world game? Yeah. I'm going to do the same thing and cheat. I'm going to recommend two things. One is a book called Console Wars by Blake J. Harris. So if you have interest in especially the era of games from the original Nintendo and the Sega Genesis and the battle between Nintendo and Sega, that book has some fascinating anecdotes about the era and what was going on at those companies at the time. And it's been optioned for two different movies, one more of a documentary, one a dramatization. I think Seth Rogen is involved in at least one of them. So that's pretty great if you're interested in this stuff. And then the game is that I want to recommend is a game called Her Story. And the way I've kind of been describing it to some people is it's like Serial, the podcast, but a game. So the entire premise is you're sitting in front of this computer and you are watching police interview footage of this woman talking to the police about what seems to be a murder. And I don't want to give too much of the plot away or anything, but you are sitting on this at this ancient computer. You can only enter like simple search terms and it will only bring up 5 results. And you don't have the police side of the interview, you only have the woman. So you can type in, say, murder, and you'll bring up clips of, you know, 30 seconds to a minute long of this woman talking about this man who seems to have been murdered. And so your job is to piece together what happened from, you know, just searching for whatever you want to. So it's a really non-linear narrative that is really fascinating. And there is kind of an end. You can kind of, you know, decide, unlike Serial, that there is perhaps an answer that you can get to. And it's just a fascinating game experience. I think it's on iPad and PCs and stuff. So
it's like Clue for the new generation.
Yeah, kind of.
That sounds amazing. Actually, I want to check it out.
Michelle.
Yeah, I've got a book. It has nothing to do with video games, but it does have to do with crime and 80s nostalgia of a sort. It came out in February. It's a novel called My Sunshine Away. The author is M.O. Walsh. And this is a novel that it's a debut novel that completely blew me away. It's the narrator lets you know in the opening pages that when he was a young man that something terrible happened to a fellow student at his junior high on his street. And by the way, he was one of the suspects. And you spend the whole novel watching this crime and the aftermath unfold, and you don't actually know if the guy who's narrating it to you is one of the good guys or if he's the really bad guy. And it drips with atmosphere. I think one of the reasons why I loved it is that he's writing about he's in suburban Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I live not far from there at about the same era, and he captures it perfectly. There's this whole Southern Gothic feel of beautiful suburbia, and behind the closed doors, really ugly things are happening.
No.
So I that's my tout.
Cool. Sold.
Your tout was dripping with atmosphere too. I love
I tried.
Yeah.
Chris, would you like to drip with atmosphere?
Yes, I'll try and drip. Mike Rochelle, I'll try. I have a quickie video combo tout, three things. If you want to play some Atari games, we got you whipped up. You can go onto iTunes, and you can get there is an actual Atari app on iTunes called Atari's Greatest Hits.
Got it right here.
Of course you do, Mike Rochelle. I love it. You can play like Missile Command. I think you have to buy tokens now. I'm not sure. They've changed it from the first time I got on. But it's pretty fun. Second, if you like kind of reminiscing a little bit like we did today, there's a cool podcast I like called The Retroist by a guy named Vic Sage. And he talks about everything from ColecoVision games to like Fraggle Rock, Land of the Lost, vintage commercials. It's just kind of a cool show. So definitely check it out. And finally, don't go see the movie Pixels, but do go online and watch that 2010 French animated short film that it was based on that we were talking about earlier.
So
much
I guess
better.
It would be Patrick Jean.
Yes. Patrick Jean. Who is now doing like Audi commercials and things for Hermes. He was a graphic designer and has kind of put his career on the map. So
cool. I'm going to go with a different kind of nerdiness.
Nice.
So if you're an art nerd, you would know that it's really hard to find art magazines and books in Dallas. I mean, we have the Taschen bookstore at the Jewel, but that's mostly coffee table books. So a gallery that reopened in a new space this weekend called Circuit 12 Contemporary opened the first ever Dallas gallery store. And it's basically like a museum store redux, but mostly books and magazines. It's really cool.
Where is it?
It is on Levy Street in the Design District.
Cool. I went on their opening and it is cool. They had cool books and art, and I found a cool slingshot.
Yeah.
Kind of an artful slingshot.
Yeah, it's quote curated by artistic duo. So
I'm going to tout a book as well. It's not brand new, but it's new enough. It's called Season of the Witch. It's a fantastic nonfiction account of San Francisco after the Summer of Love, basically the late 60s into the 80s. Season of, well, the witch. Pretty ugly times in many ways, kind of a long hangover from the 60s, written by a native, David Talbot, who just knows the history of that area backward and forward. You know, if you think you know everything about Altamont or Patty Hearst, many different subjects. I was there then, and it was a very strange place to grow up, and this book captures it extremely well, Season of the Witch. Brian Elledge is telling me I can talk some more now. You'll find links to some of the things we've talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com, the entertainment website of the Dallas Morning News. Drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com or send us a tweet at mixedmediapod. You can now subscribe to our show in iTunes.
Finally. Yay.
That's crazy. Did I just say that? You can now subscribe to our show in iTunes. I just said it again.
I meant to mention at the top of the hour, and I forgot.
Just search for our name, Mixed Media, yo, up in iTunes. Mixed Media is engineered by Brian Elledge and produced by Christopher Wynn. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode. Until then, for Christopher Wynn and Lauren Smart, I'm Chris Wagner. We thank you for joining us.